This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
If Clinton had won, she probably would have, you know, issued regulations and other policies that would have given renewable energy a more stable long-term market signal, which is really important. And I think going forward, there really isn't going to be a market signal from a policy perspective for wind and solar. They're just going to have to compete strictly on a market basis once the tax credits expire.
Even the most astute followers of the news may have missed that the Trump administration is touting a series of self-proclaimed focal areas. With compelling revelations of lying, collusion, and treason coming out almost daily, it's understandable if absurd, toothless initiatives like Energy Week or Workforce Development Week flew under your radar. Today on Sea Change Radio, we try to decipher what the actual energy policies of the current administration are, with the help of Axios energy reporter Amy Harder. We discuss Harder's piece, What Trump Gets Wrong About Coal, Natural Gas, and Carbon, analyze the divides within various federal agencies, and try to make heads or tails of what she dubs a collection of contradictions. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Amy Harder. Amy is an energy reporter at Axios. Amy, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
So Amy, you are a longtime energy reporter, worked for the National Journal and the Wall Street Journal. You've moved recently over to Axios. A lot of people may have read Axios articles this year without really knowing much about it. Why don't you explain what Axios is?
Definitely. Well, we are 2 days older than the Trump administration. That's when we launched, and we're founded by the people who started Politico. So I was intrigued for a whole host of reasons. I don't need to get into now, but the mission was something I really identified with, that we're trying to cut through the noise, only telling people things that they need to know, and doing it in a way that readers actually want to read it. We're putting the reader first, whereas I think a lot in journalism, journalists put themselves first. And despite the fact that the media has become a story in and of itself, given the Trump administration's attacks on the media, I don't want to be the story. I want to cover the story in an unbiased, clear way. So that was one thing that really intrigued me. I have a weekly column that runs every Monday called Harder Line, and it's where I try to distill complicated energy and environmental topics in about 800 words or so, and to let readers know and kind of cutting through the noise of what the administration is saying or what some energy companies and environmental groups might be saying. And we also have a lot of daily newsletters on a host of different topics, and I help contribute to the energy one, which is called Generate. And so that goes out every day, and so I encourage everybody to read that as well.
Recently, the Trump administration touted its quote-unquote Energy Week, and you also wrote a piece on June 19th on Axios entitled What Trump Gets Wrong About Coal, Natural Gas, and Carbon. First, why don't you tell us what Energy Week was? What did we miss?
Well, the Energy Week is just the latest in a series of these themed weeks that the administration has been touting over the last few weeks. We had a jobs week, there was an infrastructure week, and in fact, most of Washington and the country are really focused on other things, such as the healthcare bill and ongoing issues with Russia and whatnot. But nonetheless, as an energy reporter, I've been pretty focused on Energy Week and trying to extract some news out of it and trying to fact check some of the things that the administration has been saying. So there were a series of speeches throughout the week. And in particular, there was one day where the administration had a big event at the Energy Department, including a speech by the president. And really, the message was energy dominance, which implies that Trump wants America to be the most dominant energy producer. Now, the U.S. is already the biggest producer of oil and natural gas in the entire world. And it's not clear exactly how Trump is going to make America even more energy dominant. But nonetheless, the rhetoric is incredibly, incredibly aggressive. And so I think that was one big thing we saw out of that week. The initiatives that the administration announced, however, were more symbolic and long term than actually substantively different from what the Obama administration has done on a lot of these issues. For example, they announced that they're going to do a study on nuclear power, but a study doesn't really do anything. And nuclear power is struggling to be economically sufficient in this electricity markets. And so I interpreted that study as being just an excuse not to do anything on an issue that they say that they support. So I think we saw mostly rhetoric out of this energy week, which I think is kind of what has happened with these other themed weeks, because there's only so much that the administration can do without Congress. And Congress has been unwilling to do big pieces of legislation on energy and environmental issues, generally speaking.
And in general, the Trump administration hasn't really been able to pass any significant policies, not just limited to the environmental and energy sectors, right?
Correct. I mean, I think we're all at least keeping an eye on the debates about the health care bill and the chances of that going down by the day, it appears. And also the prospects for tax reform. The administration still seems to be confident that they can get something done by the end of the year, though most other people are more pessimistic than that. Energy and environmental and climate change issues are notoriously so complicated, and sometimes they don't break down along partisan lines. There's a lot of geographical divisions among lawmakers, depending on, you know, what types of energy resources are in their states. And so Congress really hasn't tackled a major energy bill in about a decade now. 2007 was the last time that Congress passed a big energy bill, and there's been no climate bill that Congress has ever passed that has been substantive in its impact. So I think there's a reason for that. I think it's incredibly difficult, and climate change itself is a big and serious issue, but it's also not very tangible. It's not something like gay marriage, where you might have a cousin who's gay or a son, or it's not something like healthcare, where you have, you know, the prospect of losing the ability to be able to afford something. Climate change is a little bit more intangible than that. And so I think those are some of the reasons why I don't anticipate Congress to be addressing climate change or energy, for that matter, anytime soon.
And from my discussions with conservatives, it seems like the messaging has been effective in getting through to the right wing in terms of speaking towards the intangible nature of climate change. It goes back to the 70s, 80s tree hugger generalization of environmentalists, people who aren't realistic. These people aren't really focusing on the matters at hand. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. And I mean, I would characterize it more as the right taking advantage of the fact that because climate change is so intangible, it's really hard to really pinpoint exactly why it's really good or why it's really bad. So, you know, during the last big climate debate in Congress about 7 years ago, the right was effective at labeling this climate bill, which created this system called a cap and trade, where there's a cap on the amount of carbon emissions that can be emitted into the atmosphere, and companies could then buy and sell credits to stay underneath that cap, credits of carbon. So the right, including some industry and a lot of conservative interest groups, successfully labeled that a tax. Now, I would note, though, that that bill didn't go anywhere in a Senate and House. Well, the House did pass it, but nonetheless, Congress as a whole did not pass that bill, and it was both chambers were controlled by Democrats. So this is a difficult issue even on the left. So it's not just that the right has labeled it a killer for jobs. I think that they've been successful in that. I would note that it's certainly not as much of a jobs killer as it has been labeled, but there are winners and losers in an energy transition, and coal has continued to go down regardless. And I think any sort of price on carbon emissions would hurt coal even more.
I was surprised to learn how relatively few coal jobs there are in this country. From watching the debates over the last couple of years, they lasted forever, it seemed like. You'd think that coal jobs were one of the biggest sectors of this country, but that's not the case, is it, Amy?
No, and that's not necessarily surprising. I mean, politicians often seize on salient talking points and salient imageries to convey a message that doesn't necessarily bear out in reality. I mean, you see the same thing in the manufacturing sector, talking about how Trump wants to revive the Rust Belt and bring back factories. Well, those factories are never coming back. And the amount of people that have ever been employed in them was never as nearly as high as the Trump administration has conveyed. And the very same thing is true for the coal industry. The coal industry has been slowly and gradually declining over the last couple of decades for a lot of reasons. One, because of technology. Technology has enabled coal mines to operate much more efficiently with far fewer people. You know, I've been to both a surface mine and an underground mine, and talking with the coal miners there, you know, they were explaining to me how technology has removed the need for a lot of jobs, and that has really nothing to do with policies and politics. Now, that being said, some of the policies that the Obama administration issued over the last 8 years, they did have an impact, and I think it's unfair to the debate to say that these environmental regulations over the last 8 years had no impact. But the biggest impact is the fact that the U.S. has discovered over the last decade a huge amount of natural gas across the U.S., and natural gas burns 50% fewer carbon emissions than coal when burned. And so natural gas got suddenly cheaper and it's cleaner. And so utility companies made the market-based decision to switch from coal to natural gas. And then the environmental regulations that the Obama team put in place really just sort of cemented that transition so it wouldn't reverse over the next few years. I like to describe it as a 1-2 punch. The cheap natural gas was the first punch, and then the EPA regulations kind of accelerated a transition that was already underway.
So in your piece, What Trump Gets Wrong About Coal, Natural Gas, and Carbon, you start off by saying the closest thing President Trump has to a climate and energy policy is actually a collection of contradictions. Now, rather than trying to decipher a lot of the things that this president, who obviously does not, by all accounts, care too much or know too much about policy. He likes to throw out big sweeping statements. Let's not dissect that, but you do say that there are some contradictions and some misleading statements coming from top officials who I'd like to explore a little bit more. You've studied the oil and gas industry a lot, and the Secretary of State is the former CEO of Exxon, Rex Tillerson, and you've also done a lot of important reportage over the years on the EPA, and Scott Pruitt is somebody who's sued the EPA quite a bit and is now running this organization. Why don't you give us kind of a summary of their positions on some of the key components of the energy sector, and then we can kind of take it from there.
Yeah, well, the reason why I described it as, you know, the closest thing that the president has to a climate and energy policy is just a collection of contradictions is because there really isn't a coherent energy policy other than just touting the fact that America is the world's biggest oil and gas producer. And so I was trying with this piece, I was trying to contextualize and make sense for readers who may just be diving into this issue every now and again, try to explain, you know, in simple terms, what's going on. And I think the biggest contradiction, and the one that actually prompted me to do the whole piece, was the fact that when the president announced that he was going to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris climate deal, which is a global deal that almost every country in the world agreed to in December 2015 to address climate change. In announcing that decision, Trump and the EPA administrator and other officials kept saying that, well, the U.S. is already reducing carbon emissions because of innovation and natural gas, and U.S. carbon emissions are at levels not seen since 1994. And in fact, that's a true statement. But the reason why natural gas has been enabling this drop in U.S. carbon emissions is because it's replacing coal in the electricity sector. Now, at the same time, though, the administration says that by pulling out of the Paris deal, they will bring back the coal industry. Now, for a whole variety of reasons, the administration can't really revive the coal industry. But even if they were to succeed in reviving the coal industry, it would then increase carbon emissions, which is exactly the talking point that they used before. So that's what I mean when it's a contradiction. If they're going to tout natural gas as a reason carbon emissions are lower, but then they say that they're going to bring coal back, the carbon emissions would go up. So there's really no coherent thesis there in terms of what they're trying to say. And I asked the administration many times to help explain what they mean by that, and I was unsuccessful in that regard, in part because they just didn't respond to my questions about this, but I certainly tried. And so I think that's the biggest thing, that the whole concept of being a zero-sum game, coal and natural gas are a zero-sum game. If you help natural gas, you hurt coal, and if you hurt coal, you help natural gas. So it's really, you can only have one or the other in terms of which one you want to prop up and benefit. So that's the biggest contradiction. But you see other ones, such as they say they want to revive the coal industry, but they're cutting funding for government R&D into the sector, and things like that. You see a lot of that. I mean, of course, the government spending is being cut across the board in the president's budget. So everything is almost getting a cut on the energy and environment front. But nonetheless, you see that there's this commitment to doing things for coal, and yet we're not actually seeing any action on that front.
The mayor never lay your head down without a hand to hold. Brother of mine, you know that I love you true. You never talk dirty behind my back, and I know that there's those that do. Oh, please, won't you bear it in mind? Love is a lesson to learn in our time. Oh, please, won't you bear it in mind?
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Amy Harder. Amy is a energy reporter for Axios. What is your gut feeling on the Tillerson versus Pruitt dynamic within the administration? Do you think they're in lockstep, or are they at loggerheads? And just in terms of where resources and messaging could be devoted in terms of coal versus natural gas versus traditional drilling as well.
In the Paris decision, we certainly saw EPA Administrator Pruitt be the more influential voice there. He was being pretty aggressive in calling for the U.S. to withdraw from the deal. He was doing interviews on Fox News and other places talking about what a bad deal it was. Now, Tillerson, in his confirmation hearing, said a couple of times that he thinks it would be better for the U.S. to remain at the table of that Paris climate deal. In the end, the Pruitt side of the debate won out, obviously, because we saw the president withdraw from the deal. So I think when it comes to climate and environmental issues, Pruitt has a lot of influence, and he's certainly the voice to the president more so than Tillerson.
And Tillerson's also been kind of bemoaning the State Department cuts at the same time, right?
Right. He certainly has been complaining about that some. I think, frankly, every agency has had some concerns about the cuts, or almost every agency, I would say, has some concerns about the cuts facing them.
Except for Scott Pruitt seems to actually relish these cuts, it seems almost like. If you look back at his history, he doesn't really believe in the agency that he's running.
I would agree that out of all the agency, he's the one, you know, I've been listening to some of the hearings on Capitol Hill about the budget, and he's faced a bipartisan grilling for a lot of those cuts that have nothing to do with climate change and has more to do with some more traditional localized environmental issues. Now, he tried to say that there'll be ways to get around that, but he certainly hasn't bemoaned it quite to the extent that Rex Tillerson has. Now, it's important to note that with this budget, It's only a blueprint and a request from the administration. Congress does the appropriating process of the money itself, and Congress is unlikely to actually pass a bill that closely resembles what the Trump administration has put in its blueprint. So I think it's important that in this discussion about the budget that we remember that some of it is just about symbolism, because the cuts won't actually become law. Now, that said, I do think it nonetheless shows the priority of the administration, so we shouldn't discount it altogether.
And turning our eye away from more traditional forms of energy and looking towards the future, is there a possibility that there could be some momentum for funding for clean energy pursuits? You had mentioned that the administration has touted its upcoming study on nuclear power, but is there any indication from your work and your sources that there will be a push in any respect for the government to be backing renewables?
Well, I think that's a great question. And we saw some developments on this during the recent Energy Week. On nuclear power in particular, this development happened after my column, but it sort of reconfirmed the thesis. And it's yet another contradiction. They say they've been incredibly bullish on nuclear power in their rhetoric. It was the number one initiative that the president talked about in his speech during Energy Week, that he wants to have a revival of the nuclear renaissance that we've been talking about for decades. Now, you know, the nuclear industry is struggling to be financially stable amid the cheap natural gas that I talked about a few minutes ago, and for a whole host of other issues, unresolved waste issues and things like that. But the economics is the biggest thing. And so the biggest thing, ironically, that the Trump administration could do to help nuclear power is to issue regulations and or something like a carbon tax that would make other sources of energy that emit any carbon at all more expensive, because nuclear power doesn't emit any carbon. But of course, the Trump administration would never do a carbon tax, at least anytime soon, and is actually repealing any of the regulations that would help nuclear power. So I think that that's another contradiction. They give positive rhetoric to the energy source, but they don't actually pull any of the policy levers that they have at their disposal. Now, to your point about renewable energy, throughout Energy Week, we heard a lot of talk about oil and natural gas and nuclear power and coal, but we didn't hear hardly anything at all about renewable energy. And by that, I mean wind and solar power. I do think the administration did refer to nuclear power as renewable. There's been a debate about that, but because the fuel itself used in nuclear power is not renewable, it's traditionally not considered that. So, you know, I haven't seen very much positive rhetoric about wind and solar out of this administration at all. The president criticized wind power the other day when he was in Iowa, which is one of the country's biggest wind-producing states.
And we know of his long history of hating the wind turbines off of his golf courses in Scotland, where he fought tooth and nail against wind. So we know that this is one of his bugaboos, is he really hates wind power. But how much can his rhetoric translate into rolling back some of the progress that has been made over the last 10, 15 years in some of these federally backed renewables?
Yeah, that's great. I did a column about this recently. In anticipation, the Energy Department is going to release very soon a study about the reliability of the electric grid. And in that study, or talking about it, there's been some pretty negative rhetoric about the reliability and availability of wind and solar, which are both intermittent, mainly because the wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine. Nonetheless, that study, I think, has shown, and just the rhetoric around it has shown, that that wind and solar are in an uphill battle against all of these traditional fossil fuel-based electricity sources. I think for wind and solar, because of the tax credits that are in place through the next couple of years, as long as those tax credits aren't repealed prematurely, people I talk to, experts in the industry, say that wind and solar will be fine and will not take a big hit, no matter what the Trump administration does. Now, the exception, of course, is if Congress does end up repealing those tax credits early, I think that would be a huge blow to the industry. And I think everybody agrees to that. So where I do see some potential cause for concern for the renewable energy sector is in more is in the types of technologies that need more government support. Maybe some types of offshore wind turbines, for example. Offshore wind also depends heavily on the government creating a framework, a regulatory framework, because there is only one offshore wind farm in the U.S. as it stands today. And so I think the big picture is that renewable energy is not going to have a big fall off because of Trump. But that said, there's also not going to be a big gain. I think if Clinton had won, she probably would have issued regulations and other policies that would have given renewable energy a more stable long-term market signal, which is really important. And I think going forward, there really isn't going to be a market signal from a policy perspective for wind and solar. They're just going to have to compete strictly on a market basis once the tax credits expire.
You mentioned, Amy, that barring the tax credits being repealed prematurely, what kind of possibility exists for that in your estimation?
That's a great question. I think it all, 90% of it depends upon whether or not Congress does anything on tax reform. I think if they don't, they're probably safe because, despite the fact that the Trump administration seems to not actually be supportive of wind and solar, wind and solar have a lot of support from Republicans, in particular wind. The wind trade group likes to point out a statistic that shows something like 88 or 86% of the wind capacity in this country is in Republican districts.
Yeah, and T. Boone Pickens, one of the more conservative entrepreneurs, has invested heavily in Texas, et cetera, right?
Exactly. I think wind and solar are both, they enjoy bipartisan support. The problem with those two sources from a political perspective is something that plagues everything that happened over the last 8 years. Pretty much anything that Obama has touted as a policy of his administration has been tainted from the perspective of the Trump administration. So I think you see that on everything.
Yeah, like in healthcare, for example. If it didn't have Obama's name on it, Republicans might be just perfectly happy with the current state of the healthcare system.
Right, exactly. And so on these tax credits, so I think if tax reform doesn't happen, the chances are very, very slim. But tax reform does happen, I anticipate somebody somewhere will try to get likely some conservative interest groups that don't like these tax breaks, tax credits. They'll likely try to push an early repeal of these tax credits as a way to pay for the tax bill, as a way to help to pay for the tax bill. And that's the type of conversation that's probably going to happen in the 11th hour, 2 a.m. on a Saturday before a Monday deadline to pass the tax bill. That's the type of environment people have told me would happen, including administration officials have said, well, the only way we could see them being repealed is if it happens at an 11th hour debate in Congress. Now, the problem with that for the renewable energy industry is that they don't have an administration that will go to bat and defend those tax credits in a way that Obama and or Clinton have done. So I think the renewable energy industry is putting on a strong face, but privately they're incredibly worried about that because it's a low probability, right? Because Congress has a hard time doing most big things. Tax reform seems increasingly out of reach. It's a low probability, but high risk. If it happens, it could be a death knell for the industry and could, really stop growth in its tracks.
Well, I highly recommend people continue to read your work over at Axios to keep an eye on the latest happenings in the energy sector. You do great work, and it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Amy Harder of Axios, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Melvin Van Peebles and John Martin.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.